Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why, in spite of an insurmountable advantage in money, the Republican Romney-Ryan ticket continues to be wrong-footed by gaffes which distract the campaign from its main message. Michelle Goldberg, a senior contributing writer to Newsweek and The Daily Beast, joins us to discuss how lucky Barack Obama appears to be in terms of candidates he has run against. Then we will speak with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, a former presidential advisor and a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command, about the president's red line in Syria regarding chemical weapons and their possible use. He has an article at The Huffington Post, "Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran." Then finally, we will speak with Robert Naiman, who back in June delivered a letter signed by Michael Moore, Oliver Stone and Noam Chomsky and others to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, urging Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa to approve Julian Assange's request for asylum. We will discuss the WikiLeaks founder's current predicament and the questions that Robert Naiman feels the press aren't asking, principally whether Assange's extradition to Sweden will lead to his extradition to the United States. Now is Michelle Goldberg, who's a senior contributing writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, winner of the 2008 J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award and the Ernesto Drinker Ballad Book Prize. Michelle Goldberg's work has appeared in Glamour, Rolling Stone, The Nation, New York Magazine, The Guardian in the UK, and The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Goldberg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And it seems that the Republican Party, they're being embarrassed about Congressman Aiken's outburst and his display of a combination of misogyny and ignorance. But nevertheless, they're enshrining his attitudes and views in their platform ahead of the Republican convention in Tampa. So I'm kind of confused.
Well, partly one of the reasons why they're so embarrassed by Todd Aiken's outburst is because he made views that they hold but kind of want to deflect attention from. He put those views at front and center. So there's kind of two parts to this. I mean, on the one hand, nobody at any point in the political spectrum, except for maybe Brian Fisher at the American Family Association, wants to defend his crazy idea about the kind of, you know, about the female body's miraculous power to deflect pregnancy in the event of rape. But this controversy is about more than just his kind of misbegotten notions about reproductive biology. It's also about his belief that women who do become pregnant as a result of rape should be forced to carry those pregnancies to term. And that is the normative view of the Republican Party. It's not Mitt Romney's view, but it is Paul Ryan's view. And I think more significantly, it is the view that's being enshrined in the 2012 Republican Party platform. So a lot of the reason that the party is so eager to push Aiken out of the race is because he's drawing attention to views that many in the party actually hold, but that they know are unpopular and that people would react badly to if they were more widely understood.
And they also want to win a Senate seat in Missouri.
Well, yeah, certainly, that's right. But I also, that is certainly correct. But the kind of vehemence with which they're trying to get rid of him, I think it's about more than just trying to win the Senate seat. You know, as is their threat to kind of withhold all this money if he stays in. It'll be really interesting to see what happens if he does stick around, how long they'll be able to, or they'll be willing to abide by that pledge.
Well, what's interesting, it seems, Michelle Goldberg, is that he's really calling the party on this division between the Tea Party and the sort of traditional Republicans, and he is actually being faithful to the Tea Party, which has always been essentially a Republican front, hasn't it, for the Republican right. So in digging his hole and digging his heels in, he's more or less saying, I'm principled and I'm not going to change my views. And I'm surprised that people like Sarah Palin aren't sticking by him, frankly, because he's an exemplar of the Tea Party.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Sarah Palin's not sticking by him. I mean, certainly you see people like Sean Hannity was basically begging him to get out of the race. At the same time, I think there is a degree of grassroots support for him. I mean, the major anti-abortion organizations are sticking by him. I interviewed a couple of people today, anti-abortion activists who are furious with the party for trying to kind of push him out of the race. You know, I've been monitoring his webpage all day, and so earlier today he said, you know, kind of show the party, you know, basically, you know, stand up to the party bosses, donate today. And he had a goal of $24,000 in 24 hours. A little while ago, that hit $29,000, and they changed the goal to $100,000 by midnight, which suggests to me that the money's coming in.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Goldberg, as a senior contributing writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. And Michelle, you have written about the idea that women cannot conceive during rape, which has been advanced by conservatives for some decades. What have you discovered in this peculiar kind of underground, bizarre anti-science literature?
Well, to me, what's interesting is that the idea really seems to originate, I mean, it possibly originates in medieval times, right? There's a very old belief from hundreds of years ago that women needed to have an orgasm in order to conceive. But more recently, it seems to originate, or if not originate, to have been kind of set down by a guy named John Wilkie, who's one of the founders of the National Right to Life Committee, a very influential person in the anti-abortion movement. In fact, in 2008, Mitt Romney sought and received his endorsement and kind of touted him as a major pro-life surrogate. But what's interesting is that the in this article that John Wilkie wrote, kind of explaining the biological reasons that women kind of couldn't get pregnant or are very unlikely to get pregnant in the event of genuine trauma, he urges all anti-abortion activists to not to use the term rape by itself, but to always use the term forcible rape or assault rape. And he wants to do that for two different reasons. One, to differentiate it from statutory rape, which can just, you know, be having consensual sex with someone who's underage. But he also wants to differentiate it from women who just kind of claim rape after they become pregnant. You know, so he makes a case that, you know, kind of we can't believe the rape statistics, because while some people may underreport rape, there's also people who claim that they've been raped after they become pregnant for consensual sex. So what's interesting is that there is this kind of, you know, decision to use the term forcible rape, which again implies that there are kind of lesser types of rape, and also I think implies a certain suspicion of women who say that they've been raped. And the reason this is significant, of course, is, well, twofold. One, because, you know, Aiken later said that when he talked about legitimate rape, he really meant to use the term forcible rape. But beyond that, you know, forcible rape is a term that that Paul Ryan, now the vice presidential candidate, has repeatedly tried to write into federal law when he was trying to further restrict federal funding for abortion.
And he wrote a 1,500-word essay, Paul Ryan, on the subject with the eye-opening title of "The Cause of Life Can't Be Severed from the Cause of Freedom." So his reputation is one as an economic wonk. But he's been very much at the forefront of this effort to redefine rape, or I mean, it's all a part of this effort to make abortion more difficult.
Well, Ryan, I mean, look, Ryan's policy positions are basically indistinguishable from Todd Aiken's. You know, Ryan believes that there should be no that abortion should be banned, and there should be no exception for rape and for rape or incest. Or health concerns. I think he believes that the only exemption he would be allowed it would be to save a woman's life. As a matter of fact, Paul Ryan has a 100% lifetime ranking by the national lifetime voting ranking by the National Right to Life Committee, and Todd Aiken is actually a little bit worse than that by their accounting. There was one term during which he only scored 90%.
Boy, well, I'm sure he's made up for it now, though, hasn't he? But Michelle, you were just talking about this fellow Wilkie and his strange beliefs that have percolated into the mainstream thinking, and particularly have influenced Aiken and Ryan. How do they get around the fact that the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology tell us that 32,000 women conceive during rape every year?
Well, I'm pretty sure that Todd Aiken has never had occasion before this to pay any attention to the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. You know, so he's not really, basically this is kind of it was one of those received ideas that kind of percolates around the, the anti-abortion subculture, and that he probably never really gave that much thought to be honest, which is, one of the things that's so galling is this is a person who is presuming to make laws that are going to affect the lives of all American women, a person who sits on the House's Committee on Science, who it's not that he had kind of strong, well-founded beliefs. He just had this sort of vague idea that there was something he'd read once. And so, he's not standing by that anymore. He now admits, that women can become pregnant as a result of rape. And the idea that they can't is certainly not something that's integral to the anti-abortion movement, right? There's plenty of anti-abortion activists who go around the country lecturing about how they were products, that they were conceived in rape, and didn't they have a right to live?
Well, just to broaden this out a little, Michelle Goldberg, into obviously it's all in the context of the presidential race. And it would seem that if President Obama were to get the votes that he got in 2008, it would be a walk for him, and we wouldn't be having any kind of political discussions about this race, which for all, basically most of the punditry seem to think it's going to be quite close. It does seem that the people who are investing record amounts of money in the Romney campaign and the super PACs, and we are at a time in American life where millions of Americans who want to vote and who are eligible to vote and have voted before and who want to vote for a Democrat have to jump through hoops to prove who they are, whereas a handful of billionaires who are buying the election for the Republicans don't have to identify who they are. So we already have this bizarre, unlevel playing field, if you will. But it seems to me the strategy is spend unlimited amounts of money, suppress as many votes as you can, and perhaps we'll have a little foreign policy incident that might help us, and we'll win. The only thing that seems to be screwing up this game plan is the quality of the candidates themselves. Mitt Romney, who managed to go abroad and step in it with various gaffes. And, obviously Ryan is not responsible for this, but in a way, Todd Aiken and Ryan are indistinguishable. So it seems that given that Obama doesn't seem to have a clear message, except that the other guys are terrible, which is a...
I don't know. I would actually disagree with that. I think that Obama's running on a, that liberals don't give kind of Obama enough credit for the serious accomplishments of that, of his presidency. Obama is also running on the fact that he, unlike, any Democrat in modern history, has succeeded in at least starting the process of reforming our health system. He's running on the fact that he has done far more for gay and lesbians than any president in American history, that he has, done as much as he possibly can to provide some sort of relief for, immigrant kids who were brought here by their parents and are now, seeking to stay in the only country that they've ever known. So I would push back on the idea that he doesn't have a message.
Well, I recently had a conversation with Amitai Etzioni, who said that there was a focus group done, I think, by CNN recently where they had independent voters. And the assumption's always been that the center in this country ultimately decides. And this focus group was asked, what are the Republican talking points? And they could all recite them accurately and easily. But then when a question was asked, what are the Democratic talking points? There was a deathly silence. And even though I agree with you that Obama has accomplished a lot, I just don't get the impression that it seems to me that the people that hate him are so motivated and they're going to vote. And the people who voted for him last time, a lot of them seem to be disillusioned. And I'm just not sure how clear and simple the message is vis-a-vis what we hear from the Republicans.
I don't disagree with you that there might have been a failure of communication, but I would just argue that I would push back against the case that that's a problem of kind of, I think the problem is less substance than and more a problem of communication.
Well, there's no question that that the president has done as best as he can with what with what's been handed him, and the point
well,
I was
not just that he's done the best that he can. I think that it has kind of actually a fairly remarkable record of accomplishment.
So why are we even talking about it? Is it not clear, or is it just not clear to me?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, because there's absolutely no question that the economy is still catastrophic for a lot of people, and people are suffering enormously. And, you know, the message that it could have been a lot worse isn't one that any politician can really run on. And the message that here's all the things I would do if I didn't have a completely intransigent opposition, it, you know, also kind of only gets you so far. The other thing is that he's actually accomplished a great deal of what he said he was going to accomplish last time around. You know, I mean, think about what he ran on in 2008. He said he was going to reform healthcare, that he was going to try to bring the war in Iraq to a close, you know, that he was going to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He's done a lot of what he said he was going to do. The only kind of his challenge now is to turn the economy around. And the fact is there's almost... they've done about as much as they can do in the face of Republican opposition. They seem much less willing to spin out kind of pure fictions in the way that the Romney campaign has been.
But do you feel that there is a focus and activism on the right and not quite the same on the left? I mean,
oh yeah, certainly. I mean, yeah, I mean. Absolutely. You know, and part of that is just a function of it's always harder to get people excited about the status quo. You know, in a lot of ways, I'm reminded of 2000, in which, you know, I heard countless kind of progressives and Democrats, you know, whine about what a disappointment Al Gore was and kind of act as if, you know, it would barely matter if George W. Bush won the election, because how much worse could he really be? You know, it's amazing to me how quickly people forget that history. So, yeah, certainly the rage and the passion and that's all on the right. They see this, you know, this election as a kind of apocalyptic struggle for the future of their country. You know, again, it's very difficult, I think, to kind of muster a similar amount of passion about maintaining the unsatisfactory status quo.
Well, I think people should be passionate. I certainly feel really deeply offended and deeply angry about 5 million people being denied the vote. That mm-hmm. seems to be fundamentally un-American, and I also feel extremely disgusted with the hypocrisy, particularly of Mitt Romney, who portrays himself as a good Christian family man, and yet he is so deeply dishonest in the way he's been running his campaign, particularly his advertising. I mean, starting with the first one where he put John McCain's words in Obama's mouth, that's way back in Iowa, and the latest one with this total lie about waivers for
for welfare, yeah.
The welfare waivers, which is an absolute lie. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just outrageous that, so, you know, I would say that people on the left are kind of asleep if they don't recognize that they're being insulted here. And the ultimate insult, to my mind, is that this man won't release his taxes, either because he's hiding something or he's just plain arrogant.
I mean, I would actually say that there's something even more offensive about Romney than the fact that he won't release his taxes. I mean, I think there's two reasons for his attack on welfare. One is obviously just kind of racial demagoguery to convince people that, you know, Obama's kind of taking their money and giving it to shiftless, lazy people who don't want to work. But the other piece of it is that he is gearing up to launch, you know, the biggest kind of assault on the social safety net that we've ever seen. You know, kind of forget about his plans to turn Medicare into a voucher system. He wants to absolutely gut Medicaid. He wants to absolutely gut food stamps. You know, I mean, we're talking about 34% cuts. We're talking about, you know, kind of millions of people denied the only, you know, kind of paltry supports that our government provides them at the most kind of desperate moments of their lives. And so it's almost as if in order to do that, he has to kind of first convince people that the state has been overly generous to the poor, you know, when in fact poverty in this country is, you know, is a crisis. There's an enormous amount at stake. But part of the problem is that you were saying before that, you know, Obama has so far only been able to articulate, you know, how terrible the other guy is. And the fact is that actually is kind of a central issue in this election, is what exactly Romney plans to do to the poor and the middle class in this country.
Well, it seems that he's all about ambition without purpose. It's difficult to know why he's even running. He hasn't really made a case for what he's doing, and he's not exactly clear about what he's going to do, although I entirely agree with what you're saying is going to be the consequences. Just in closing, Michelle Goldberg, do you think then that the president is going to come out fighting here, in as much as the other side is already geared up and highly motivated, often by a kind of poisonous hatred? In his case, we've suggested that there's more of his record that can be touted, and he's being lucky in the sense that they keep wrong-footing themselves, and now instead of talking about the economy, they're talking about abortion. So is he going to continue to be lucky because the other side keeps stumbling, or do you think?
Well, you know, he is the luckiest. Obama is so consistently lucky in his political opponents, and this has been something that's, you know, a theme of his entire career, that, you know, if I actually did believe in this sort of thing, I would think that God wanted him to be president, because it, you know, the kind of the unforced errors of his opposition is just astonishing to watch.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I say. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Michelle Goldberg.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who's a senior contributing writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, which was the winner of the 2008 J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award and the Ernesta Drinker Ballard Book Prize. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg about Syria.
The moment that came because every sperm is sacred, every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Every sperm is sacred.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command and as advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has a new article in the Huffington Post, Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Ginsburg.
Thank you to be with you.
And you described the situation in Syria as a kind of witch's brew with Hezbollah, the Al-Quds Revolutionary Guard Corps from Iran, and Al-Qaeda all kind of circling around the soon-to-be carcass of the Assad clan. We have so little control, I guess, because we're you know, the Russians and the Chinese are basically screaming now that this whole red line that the president announced the other day about chemical weapons and their possible use is a pretext for U.S. intervention. Do you think that this is there's any likelihood of any U.S. intervention?
It's a tough question because the president has indicated in his press conference the other day that there are contingency plans for military intervention if indeed that red line that he indicated is crossed by the regime, that is, a regime that would deploy or otherwise provide WMD to against its adversaries or provide it to supporters. And we have to remember that Syria probably has the largest stockpile of chemical and biological weapons than any other country besides Iran in the Middle East.
So is there a possible kind of Gadamerang situation here as the Assad's fall and more defectors seem to indicate, at least that's what they're saying, that the regime is cracking from within? You have mentioned in your Huffington Post article, Ambassador Ginsburg, that they're actually the brother, the enforcer Maha, the younger brother who runs the Republican Guard, may have lost his leg in the Damascus blast that killed their brother-in-law, and that he possibly recently initialed a secret agreement with Iran and Hezbollah to have them bring in some forces. And there's a possibility, of course, of what might happen with the chemical arsenals that they have. So do you think, if I'm just thinking back to the first war against Iraq, when Saddam Hussein used Scud missiles, albeit with conventional warheads, on Israel to bring Israel into that war to break up the coalition that President George H.W. Bush had put together. Is there a possibility that Assad might use his Scuds to do the same, to bring Israel in, to save himself at the last minute, to distract the Arab world from the fact that he's a kind of pariah?
You know, Ian, you would be a very good Situation Room war game strategist by that question. And I don't think that anyone, including me, honestly, have given that a lot of thought. Is it conceivable when a regime and a dictatorial regime is prepared to fight to the last person? And since this regime essentially has come to the conclusion that it's going to take every last Syrian down with it, if it's possible, even if it has to, in effect, abandon most of the Syrian countryside. You can't put anything past this crew. This family has played for keeps ever since 1967, when the regime came to power. This is a regime that plays by Iranian rules. It doesn't play by anyone else's rules. The irony of it is that you have an ophthalmologist trained in London, who everyone had great expectations would be a reformer, who's turned out to be as ruthless as his father, so the apple doesn't fall from the tree, far from the tree.
So in terms of the witch's brew that you write about in your Huffington Post article, Ambassador Ginsburg, Obama's Syrian red line is no red light for Hezbollah or Iran. What's the bottom line message there?
The bottom line is that from a strategic perspective, both Hezbollah, which is dependent on Syria for providing it access to continued arms from Iran, and Iran, which considers Syria to be its most important client state in a Shiite arc that is going to stretch from Lebanon across Iraq and Syria to Iran, is an essential component of that Shiite-dominated arc. And the Iranians will do everything possible to keep the Assad regime in power, and they're proving it. While we are seeing political defections, and while we're seeing a much greater capacity by the Free Syrian forces to inflict significant damage on the regime, the regime troops are clearly fatigued, and you're seeing more and more Hezbollah and Iranian regular regiments enter the country.
And do you think that the fact that the Saudis are taking the lead in terms of the Free Syrian Army, that is that the entree for the Wahhabis and the Salafists and Al-Qaeda? You can't help feeling is a part of that mix.
Well, Al-Qaeda definitely is a part of the mix. There's no doubt, and they're coming in from like roaches. They're finding their way from all sorts of places in the Middle East, including Yemen, where they've been under duress from the Obama administration. The Saudis not only are providing official support to the Free Syrian Army, but there's a huge flow of money that is coming in from Saudi clerics who are using their own avenues to influence the internal Sunni eventual coalition or state that will emerge. So you have, in effect, the equivalent of a 1936 Spanish Civil War, where you have all the sides in the region taking up sides against each other. And Syria has become ground zero for every effort by the part of the Sunni versus the Shiite coalitions to essentially play for keeps.
But when we look at the Assad regime and its alliance with Iran and also with Hezbollah, as again using the witch's brew analogy, Al Qaeda is hardly any form of liberation. And I'm just astounded that how much we basically, I guess, because the U.S. doesn't really want to get involved in spite of what the Russians and the Chinese say. It seems pretty apparent that they have been doing minimal intervention and not even supplying arms, as far as I can tell. So, you know, there's a record of what the Saudis are about. I mean, their money and helped to form the Taliban and kept them going. They've had a profound effect in radicalizing Pakistan, and they spent a lot of money in the elections in Egypt. The Salafist party that came in second in the parliamentary elections came out of nowhere, largely because of Saudi money. They have an agenda. It's extremely reactionary.
Well, not only that, but we have to understand that the most significant component of the Sunni opposition in Syria is composed of the Muslim Brotherhood. Most people forget, and they shouldn't forget, that the Assad family has engaged in an eternal war against the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. In 1982, when the Brotherhood rose up in revolt against the father, Hafez al-Assad, he surrounded the city of Hama, which has been the site of a lot of fighting recently, and mowed down 20,000 people in order to get rid of the Brotherhood once and for all. The remnants were exiled, and now the remnants constitute a significant part of the Free Syrian Army and the leadership of the Syrian National Council.
So it's a little odd and ironic, isn't it, Ambassador Ginsburg, that we've been knocking off secular Arab regimes, albeit extremely distasteful ones, and they're being replaced in part by religious regimes.
You're going to see, and this is why I felt that the situation in Syria was so important strategically for the United States and why I believe the administration has abdicated its strategic foreign policy responsibility for political reasons and not done more without putting boots on the ground. I'm not in favor of putting boots on the ground, without doing more to influence the internal political evolution of the country, of Syria, by engaging many of the sectarian leadership in the country. You've got to understand, Syria is one of the few countries in that part of the world that has a significant number of interreligious minorities, and it has a Yugoslavian flavor to it.
Well, the Christians are already, they've been aligning themselves. They're only 10%, but they've been aligning themselves with Assad purely because they fear the very specter of an al-Qaeda-type fundamentalist Islamic purge.
Well, al-Qaeda is, like any other terrorist organization, sees an opportunistic possibility of influence events inside Syria. And they have already been operating, as you know, next door in Iraq. There's been a resumption of sectarian strife in Iraq that most Americans would just as soon forget. But as soon as our troops got out, and those of us who understand Iraq realized that we've left in charge a prime minister who's slowly but surely becoming a puppet of the Iranian government, we more or less will wake up and realize that we got rid of Saddam only to in effect drop Iraq into the lap of the Iranians.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, the former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and he serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has a new article at the Huffington Post, "Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran." Let's just turn this to Israel, Ambassador Ginsburg, because the press over there is abuzz with speculation that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak are determined to attack Iran before the U.S. elections. That seems to be the gist of the speculation, which is at a sort of fever pitch now. It's very hard to understand, and I believe there's the press in Israel is reporting that there's a lot of resistance to this from the defense and intelligence professionals, I think in part because this would be a huge reprieve, would it not, for the Assads, for Hezbollah, and for Iran if Israel were to attack Iran and basically take the, in effect, with the Assads on the ropes, as at this moment, that situation would reverse itself.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The Israelis have their own timetable. There's clearly significant, unprecedented public disagreement inside the Israeli military and political establishment over the consequences and effectiveness of an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear installations, particularly without being certain what the United States would do in the event of an Israeli attack, because the consequences strategically to Israel and the United States are significant, as well as to the average American who will wind up having to pay at the pump for that type of consequence of the Straits of Hormuz closing. But let's also be realistic. The Israelis have a completely different sense of their exposure and vulnerability to Iran than we do. And we cannot, and the United States cannot, in effect, put a complete clamp on how Israel is going to act or not act in the face of Iran's continuing provocations and threats against it. I mean, just the other day, it's not as if the Iranians are trying to keep the situation from getting worse. Just the other day, Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, declared that Israel is a cancer in the world and it needs to be eradicated. Well, when you hear those statements, you know, what do you do if you're an Israeli prime minister? I'm not suggesting, by the way, by my comments, that I support the idea of an attack, given the fact that I understand how the consequences would play out to Israel and the rest of the region, but let's also give the Israelis some slack in understanding that they are dealing with a completely different framework of reference than we are.
So just back to your article in the Huffington Post, Ambassador Ginsburg, Obama's Syrian red line is no red light to Hezbollah or Iran. Just explain that kind of worst-case scenario that could happen in terms of these chemical arsenals. And I spoke yesterday to one of the former UN special weapons inspectors in Iraq at the Monterey Institute, Ray Zelinskas, and he said there's 24 sites, and presumably the U.S. has overheads and drones looking at this stuff, but it's pretty hard to watch all of them, and it's possible, as you've suggested, that they could be transferred into the hands of Hezbollah and the Iranians, and where the Assad regime may get some kind of deniability on their use. How would that scenario play out?
Well, that's the worst-case scenario, with one added wrinkle, that given the lawlessness and the breakdown of civil authority and the defections of Syrian military forces. There's no telling who would wind up using chemical weapons first. Let's just suppose a significant Syrian battalion decides to defect that's overseeing the WMD stockpile in the city outside of Aleppo, and they wind up using that weapon against some of the Syrian forces. That is the Assad forces. Well, what happens next? Who do you blame? What do you do? Does the United States act? There are so many different scenarios that it's scary, because in the end, as none of us really know how much they have. Anyone who essentially claims publicly that they know how many WMD sites there are is probably guessing at best. But let's be real. They have dispersed huge stockpiles of WMD all over the country. And who knows, as the Assad regime loses its grip on power outside of Damascus, who's going to wind up being responsible for their first use? It is what has scared those of us who've watched Syria from the beginning of this revolt, and for the life of us could not understand why the West was not being more actively involved in trying to do more to prevent this situation and this scenario from emerging.
And there's also the other aspect, right, you mentioned in your article, of the possibility of just pure criminality of selling some of this.
Well, you have to understand that inside, just think of what's going on inside a town or a village in Syria. You have criminal gangs kidnapping people. You have criminal gangs extorting money. You have Sunni clerics giving money to al-Qaeda to buy weapons and to buy medicine. You have Free Syrian forces trying to gain control over the population, and you have a population that is increasingly despondent, desperately in need of medical and humanitarian relief, and not getting anything. So where do you think these people are going to go? They're going to go to the first person who can offer them a bandage or portable water.
So given that you're a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command, the New York Times carried a story yesterday saying that the only way that the U.S. has a rapid response team that's capable and trained of going in and securing chemical weapons, are they anywhere near being deployed? Is that?
I really don't know. I wouldn't know, and I wouldn't even suggest to you that I know.
Sure. You did know, you probably shouldn't tell me anyway.
But. Well, I won't go there. But suffice to say that when Pakistan's nuclear arsenal was becoming increasingly unstable in terms of security. I know the United States has contingency plans for that. But remember, Syria is a big country, and if we drop troops into Syria, well, who the hell knows what the Russians are going to do next after that?
Or the Chinese.
Well,
they won't do anything, but they're certainly.
I'm worried more about the Russians than I am about the Chinese, because the Chinese don't have troops on the ground in Syria. The Russians do.
Well, again, we get back to the witch's brew, I suppose, and your bottom line, though, appears to be that the U.S. has not been sufficiently involved, allowing the Saudis to introduce their extremist elements, and had we been involved in terms of the opposition, we may have some sway or influence over the post Assad regime.
We basically said to the Saudis and to the Turks and to the Israelis, we're turning our back on this one, baby, and it's an inconvenience to us right now. This is now several months ago. And the Saudis said, fine. And the Qataris, who were, by the way, just as active as the Saudis in this, also said, fine. The Turks have lurched from being involved to not being involved. So there hasn't been really any American or Western leadership to help bring a break and to coordinate a strategy. That will be the legacy, more or less, of the Obama administration's policy on Syria.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Ian.
Good to talk to you again. Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and he serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the U.S. Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has a new article in the Huffington Post, Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back speaking with Robert Naiman about the Assange asylum and what the press aren't reporting or should be reporting about Julian Assange's fate.
I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around, and I'll keep this world from dragging me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Naiman, a policy director at Just Foreign Policy. He edits the Just Foreign Policy Daily News Summary and writes on U.S. foreign policy at the Huffington Post. Previously, he was a policy analyst and researcher at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Naiman.
Good to be with you.
And back in June, you delivered a letter that was signed by Michael Moore, Oliver Stone, Noam Chomsky, and many, many others, Bill Maher, Daniel Ellsberg, etc., along with a petition. You delivered it to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, urging President Rafael Correa, of the president of Ecuador, to approve Julian Assange's request for asylum. Obviously, that has happened, but there's also a standoff there. What is your next step? In other words, I mean, I read the piece by both Oliver Stone and Michael Moore in the New York Times, and it was a very well written, I thought, and very well reasoned article. What's the next step for those who are trying to, I suppose, free Julian Assange? How would you describe your political project?
Well, right now there is a dynamic between the government of Ecuador, the government of Britain, and the government of Sweden. The government of Ecuador is trying to get the government of Britain and Sweden, especially Britain, to negotiate seriously, to negotiate in good faith. Julian Assange is willing to go to Sweden, as he has stated repeatedly, but he wants some assurance that when the Swedish legal process is complete, Sweden will not extradite to the United States to face a U.S. prosecution related to WikiLeaks. And the government of Ecuador has been pressing this case. It offered, for example, for Sweden to question Julian Assange in their embassy in London. Sweden refused. Ecuador asked Sweden to give assurances that they wouldn't extradite Assange to the United States. Sweden refused. Ecuador asked the British government they would give assurances to oppose U.S. extradition request from Sweden. They refused. So that is what led to the present standoff, from the Ecuadorian point of view at least. It's the refusal of the British and Swedish governments to meet them halfway, to make some assurance that they would not send Julian Assange to the United States. Our role in this, I think, is to publicize, or our main role, is to publicize the main issues that have previously been submerged. The official story of the British, Swedish, and U.S. government and Australian government has been that there's no relationship between this British-Swedish legal pursuit of Julian Assange and the threat of U.S. prosecution of WikiLeaks. And there's no reason to be concerned that about the possibility that Sweden might send Julian Assange to anything. This is just, you know, some paranoid fantasy. That's the, you know, the implication of the official story. But these questions of why, you know, if it's true that there's no relationship, that there's no threat, then you ask, well, then why wouldn't Sweden agree to question Assange in London? Why won't Sweden agree not to send Assange to the United States? Why won't Britain agree not to permit Julian Assange to be sent to the United States? These are questions that Michael Moore and Oliver Stone asked in their New York Times op-ed. These are questions that we've been raising in all our writing. And just today or yesterday, we launched a petition to the New York Times asking the New York Times, please investigate and try to establish answers to these questions, which government officials, including U.S. officials, have refused to address.
Now, just a quick question. Robert, are you on a speakerphone?
I'm on a cell phone.
Oh, you're on a cell phone. I guess there's a bit of an echo, that's all.
Is that better?
Sure. Okay. So let me, again, mention that I'm speaking with Robert Naiman, the policy director at Just Foreign Policy, where he edits the Just Foreign Policy Daily News Summary, and he also was a researcher at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and he delivered a petition back in June to the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I guess that was at the time when, just after Julian Assange had skipped bail and effectively defected, I guess, to that embassy, calling upon the president of Ecuador to grant Julian Assange political asylum, which he has done. It's led to this standoff, which will probably continue for some time. But then there's an old song, I fought the law and the law won. And I'm wondering, to what extent is we don't know, and the questions you asked haven't been answered, or indeed they haven't even been asked, about guarantees from the Swedes that they wouldn't extradite him, guarantees from the U.S. authorities that they're not out to get him, etc. But just in terms of the Swedish authorities and the British authorities, how much do you think this is simply a case of the legal authorities being just, you know, he poked them in the eye and they're saying, screw you, you know. The last thing you do is pick a fight with a cop. At least that's my thinking. So in the case of the Swedes, he basically gave his back of his hand to the Swedish authorities, and the same with the Brits. He'd skip bail and hit out in this embassy. So do you think that that's an element, or you think that there is a real vendetta here to get him?
Well, I think it's pretty hard to pull apart the two things. We don't have any way of, you know, seeing into the minds of the authorities and allocating, you know, causation between two things that point in the same direction. So on the one hand, these are governments that are very close to the United States. They have close security cooperation in the United States. Britain, you know, major U.S. ally in the illegal war in Iraq, for example, among many other things that you could cite. Sweden also close security cooperation with the United States. So on the one hand, the historical pattern for these countries is close cooperation with the United States. And we know that the United States, according to U.S. press reporting, has an active ongoing, and statements of U.S. officials, an active ongoing investigation on WikiLeaks. So we know that the U.S. is interested in Assange. We know that the U.S. is prosecuting Bradley Manning in the same case. We know that other court documents indicate a U.S. investigation of other members of WikiLeaks. On the other hand, we know that, obviously these governments and these authorities enjoy their power. And in the case where they don't feel they have to make any accommodation, then, there's a tendency to say that they won't. So, for example, if you look at the press reports from Sweden, where some people have attempted to press the why question, people in the Swedish legal profession explaining the Swedish government's actions say, well, it's become a matter of prestige. That's not as serious. Our pride is at stake. We have to get this guy. Well, if it were somebody important to them, if it were a government official of a friend of the country, if it were a rich or famous person, they would have a different attitude. You look at how Bill Clinton was questioned in the Paula Jones case, or Karl Rove was questioned in the Valerie Plame case. In these cases, prosecutors are very polite, very deferential. But Julian Assange is a member of the hoi polloi. So, in addition to being, kind of public enemy number one in the Western media. So you see the two things overlap. And it's hard to say, is it because, they're bullies? Or is it their natural tendency to be bullied, which is allowed to be made manifest because the victim of the bullying is somebody who's a public enemy, according to the West? Or is it that, they're going after him because he's public? How do you distinguish those two things when they overlap so greatly? I think it's clear that, and Glenn Greenwald pointed out in his column in The Guardian today, that the U.S. campaign and the hysterical reaction of the Western government to WikiLeaks far predates the Swedish government case. It far predates the WikiLeaks publishing the U.S. diplomatic cable. Anyhow, already declared WikiLeaks to be a threat long before that. There's a long-run trend, a very unfortunate trend, of a crackdown on government whistleblowers in the United States, of which this is a part.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Naiman.
It's good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Naiman, a policy director at Just Foreign Policy, where he edits the Just Foreign Policy Daily News Summary, and previously he was a policy analyst and researcher at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manos and Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.